First thing I woke up this morning, it was four. So.
Good morning.
I guess the sooner we get into this, the sooner we get out of this. So.
We'll jump in. We've got a little bit of a head start from yesterday, so we're sort of running one topic ahead of schedule. I think we'll bounce straight into it. So we're starting with issue 10, which is on page 61 of agenda paper 2. Michelle.
Issue 10 is on presentation of share subscriptions receivable. Paragraph 22.7a of the IFRS for SMEs requires that receivables that arise when equity instruments are issued before the entity receives the cash for those instruments must be offset against equity. The reason there was a question in the request for information is because we've had mixed feedback from constituents on whether such receivable should be presented as an asset or adjustment to equity. Also, some national laws require the presentation of the related receivable as an asset. So the question we'd like your feedback on today is, should paragraph 22.7a be left unchanged, amended or deleted?
Anyone want to start this morning?
Start. I think my concern with this one is I understand the problem. I think my concern with this one is that we're trying to appease different jurisdictions' legislative requirements, and I feel it's not the particularly the role of the ISB to sort of work its way around every jurisdiction's requirements of whether you can do something or otherwise. So I was of the view, I wasn't particularly, wouldn't be particularly upset with it being deleted, but I was sort of, was happy with it being left as is, and if there was a particular need to depart from that, I would rely on the requirements to depart for a fair presentation in section 3, if that was so desired.
So you'd be comfortable with deleting it?
I would be
aside from the issue of having to deal with
it. Yeah, I think the first point was more of I don't think that the rules and requirements can be sort of put in mind for each jurisdiction's own requirements. So it's more of a general principle. But in this particular case, I don't think it would be particularly harmful if it was deleted.
Well, we have looked at the issue from the financial reporting perspective and ignoring what the law says here and there. But, we saw value in having the receivable shown as an asset in the circumstances where, in fact, the equity holders would be those we have not yet paid. Have exactly the same enforceable rights as the other equity holders, and when the entity would have an enforceable right to receive cash. And in other situations, we would prefer, we would think it's better reporting not to show those graphs. And that's basically the position we have taken, and you know why it could be our position in FlyFS as well.
Wait, just to remind me, IFRS at the moment is so.
Oh yes, it's silent. This is added as extra guidance and perhaps a bit of a simplification as well.
Okay, which means in essence, IFRS for SMEs is actually stricter in this sense than IFRS.
I think it was seen as providing guidance, more guidance, but.
Right, so the staff recommendation is pretty much your recommendation.
Yeah.
Is everybody comfortable with going with that?
Yes,
I.
Okay.
So deleting it.
Deleting the requirement.
I suggest that we include this in the educational material as a discussion of what is equity.
Certainly, a discussion around why.
Initial.
Absolutely, I think that's a good idea.
Maybe probably just already.
Yeah.
Have some guidance in that. Okay.
All right, moving right along.
Issue 11 was, starts around paragraph 105, and that's whether additional topics should be included in the IFRS for SMEs. The staff have listed suggestions made by two or more comment letters in paragraph 105. The staff have also provided reasoning for why we don't think any of these topics should be incorporated. So the question we'd like your feedback on is, do you think there are any additional topics that should be specifically addressed in the IFRS for SMEs, including whether or not you disagree with any of the staff views on the ones listed in paragraph 105? And this is where you think the general guidance in paragraph 10.4 to 10.6 on the accounting policy hierarchy is not sufficient to deal with those cases.
Yeah, I agree that I think the paragraphs 10.4, 10.6 cover this. I mean, if somebody really wants to give EPS, feel free to go and give it. And you know, you can use I-33. You don't have to. You can choose what you want to do. I would be very concerned about adding in any more sections. I mean, well, of the ones listed, none of those to me, and we've discussed the not-for-profits already, but the others to me were things that I think are very, very uncommon for SMEs to want. And if one of them wanted it and they wanted to use segment reporting, whatever, go for it. I would definitely not add them in.
Anybody else?
I concur.
Can we take the staff recommendation as is?
We can.
Perfect. Gee, maybe we should have just gone on for an extra half an hour last night.
Very quickly.
How about tea?
Issue 12 starts around paragraph 113. That's on Q&As. There are two questions in the request for information about the Q&A programme. The first question is whether there's a further need for Q&As. This question arose as although we've had a lot of feedback, positive feedback on the Q&As, we've also received some negative feedback as well. Some people think the Q&As are burdensome as they add another set of rules on top of the IFRS for SMEs. And also they're concerned that the Q&As can create conflict with full IFRS if it deals with issues that are also issues under full IFRS. Also, some people think that now the IFRS for SMEs has been implemented in many jurisdictions, there'll be less implementation questions, and so the Q&A program is no longer needed. So the question we'd like your feedback on is, should the Q&A program continue after the comprehensive review is completed?
Bruce?
Yeah. I was going to say that the question around the fact that it's already been implemented, I think, is irrelevant because we're about to put through more changes, which in other words, I think we'll need further Q&As. I'm supportive of a Q&A process. I guess the only comment that I did agree with that was put somewhere was that I think the status of the Q&As is misunderstood. And I think that as much as we can put as many caveats on the front of it as we want, that this is only for guidance or whatever, the reality is for SMEs and especially the practitioners, the smaller practitioners in that area, they're taking these like they would an IFRIC out of the ISB. So I think that I'm not saying I'd change the due process around them, but I think we need to realize that the authority of these things is going to be higher than I think was anticipated by the ISB. And I don't think we're going to get away from that. I think that's a reality. I also note that there is concern that has been expressed that where we're commenting on something where the wording is identical to big IFRS, as much as once again we turn around and throw the educational issue out of it, this is something that's been through a due process at the ISB, and there has been a concern, well, what if we came out and people were drawing principles out of that in big IFRS? So I guess what I'm saying is I'd support the continued use of Q&As, if that's what we decide to call them, but I do think that we need to accept that maybe the intended level that they would go in at is not what's happening in practice. And I don't really have an answer for that.
Bruce, the practitioners, if you like, are in this environment the professionals.
Yeah.
They work with this all the time, they continuously. Do you think that's the same for just the normal SME accountants out there? Are they following the Q&As at all?
They are. Well, they are as much as they do it themselves. I mean, I know most of the firms that I work with have kind of put a rule in that you will follow the Q&A. If you want the exception, then you need to talk to the technical people about why you wouldn't follow a particular Q&A. And I think that's just kind of the default of that's the safer option. You know, rather let's go with the Q&A than not go with it and then have to defend why we didn't do it. I mean, it's easier to defend. It's guidance. We chose not to, but it's obviously a lot easier to defend if we just went with something in the Q&A. So, and I think even the companies the number of companies I know who are doing the accounting themselves have done the same thing. They've picked these up and treated them as if it was part of the standard.
I think the Q&As also should be retained as a mechanism to get a change in if something is brought to the attention. So I think as a principle to retain it, I would probably advocate, though, a fairly strong filtering system in terms of the questions and issues that arise to make sure that I would have thought that the number of Q&As issued would be pretty limited, and to return to the original objectives of what the Q&As were in terms of the guidance around when was issued, and to make sure it's a real issue in practice rather than hypothetical issues or pretty limited by an individual or a jurisdiction type of issue, as opposed to a one impacting the wider interpretation in practice.
I guess the challenge for us is whether there will be enough new issues coming through at that level. In other words, that fairly high filter. Yeah. But the reverse of that is whether we will be doing enough in the educational space to help people who need the help, if we're filtering that much.
If there isn't any issues that come through, isn't any real problems in practice, so be it. It's sort of where to have a mechanism there that we can turn to if something is brought to the attention that we can issue on a relatively short-term basis would seem to be something we should keep.
And do you think under that argument, and maybe this is for both of you, there's an argument for having two tiers, a Q&A system that effectively gives authoritative guidance in those sort of circumstances where you might only do that once or twice, and something that gives more of the educational type of guidance that we're thinking of, which is non-authoritative, just trying to assist people in thinking about the right things.
Yes, with the caveat of the trying to interpret full IFRS, which potentially came up a few times in the past.
I was going to say, I mean, the interesting thing around the Q&As is I know there was a reluctance to issue interpretations on the SME standard, but I think the reality is that if we do find something needs to be, that's how they're being seen anyhow. The fact that it's not educational guidance, because this goes through the board and it's exposed, you know, there's a full process behind it. I think there's a definite distinction from the normal educational stuff that Mike and his team push up. This is gone through a due process. We've gone through this committee. It goes through the board. We're happy. It goes out, exposures, feedback. And I'm saying, given that it's going through all that, why not issue it as authoritative guidance? I mean, I like the idea of two tiers, because I think there are some of the things that are really just additional guidance. But if something comes up, the release is authoritative. I think we should be able to put it out as an authoritative guidance. And I do think it'll be read. I mean, I don't think we're going to push it.
And maybe that's the question. And I guess my concern here is, given everything we said up to now, we want this to be standalone. We want it to be a stable platform. We want it to be robust. We want people to be able to use the book and nothing else. The Q&A process, the mere existence of the Q&A process places an obligation on the preparer to monitor what's happening in that Q&A on an ongoing basis. They need to keep up to date just in case there's a Q&A that's come out that's changed something they're thinking about. And that to my mind is the distinction between something that's authoritative, not in compliance if you don't do this, and something that's educational, that's helpful, that's supplementary.
I think that the barrier I would put to issuing an interpretative guide would be very high. So, you know, if something came out, it's because we just missed an unintended consequence of the standard. There is something out there that is not achieving fair presentation, or there's something that, you know, that we just we missed it. And I mean,
and then if I follow that, then that suggests that a lot of what we would do under even a lot of the Q&As we've currently done would probably be educational type Q&As.
Absolutely.
And that sounds to me like a threshold. It's kind of like keeping something in our pocket for the just in case. But ideally, it's something that we really don't have to use, because it suggests somewhere we've got something wrong in the actual standard.
Yeah, you know, because, I mean, you don't want to get to a stage where, you know, the alternative is somebody say, oh, we can just reissue the standard if there's something real problem with that. But the moment you say we're going to reissue, then somebody will jump up and say, well, hang on, IFRS 15's been issued. Why is it? You know, and before you know it, we'll end up in an annual cycle. I think it's just, it's almost like you've ended up with the IFRIC, you know. We don't have a million IFRIC interpretations. They come out as and when a need has gone through an agenda committee and the decision has been made that there is an urgent need to do something. You know,
given having that, and then obviously that does need to go through the process, because it is an authoritative thing.
Absolutely.
It needs to go through the process of perhaps the negative kind of authorization from the entire board. Would you be comfortable with also having the educational process in place, and we would first see if we can deal with that through an educational process?
Absolutely. As I say, I think the educational process is key. And I would actually include the current Q&A program under it's kind of a mix between the education. So I'd still have the non-authoritative Q&As, you know, because they really are borderline education. But I do think that it'd be a good idea to have that mechanism that if we do see something unintended, and I don't see any yet, but, you know, just there is something that'll last to resolve those if they come up.
And then just to ask the other question, what you've said a couple of times during this is you said, because of the fact that it's approved by the board, it's seen as authoritative. So are you seeing the due process as creating that weight?
Yeah.
And if you took away that due process, it may be more aptly regarded as educational.
You know, I think that there's always a danger. I mean, the reality is I had people quoting out of the educational material to me as authoritative because there's an ISB or I4S logo. You know, the reality is I think anything that comes out of this building is seen as authoritative. And even if it's educational, I think there's always a danger that the moment the ISB or the ICF puts something out, you know, that is going to be seen as authoritative. I don't think you're going to get away from it. But I think the fact that the Q&As really do go through a full due process, similar to an interpretation type thing, I think that's why it's probably a bit more weight given.
Okay. Alex?
Yeah, I think we're in a bit of a European situation here, you know, multi-speed Europe. I think that needs to be pointed out in the sense that whereas some jurisdictions like South Africa actually adopted the IFS for SME before it actually became a standard. Yeah, some of us, like Sierra Leone, which actually officially adopted it back in, I think, late 2009, 2010, have actually postponed implementation a number of times for various reasons on the ground, and we're actually only rolling out this year. Right, so the Q&A program actually, I suspect that many other countries like us out there, right, does have continuing validity. Having taken part in it myself, I often found myself thinking there are a number of issues which we actually didn't cover, which would have had practical educational benefits to people on the ground. So I think the two-tier system is actually extremely valuable. I would like to see something like an FAQ section, right, which is purely educational and has as many issues as possible and is almost like in a searchable database once it's been issued. So practitioners and even people at the NSS level who just want to double-check some things can go there and just check to see what we've, you know, what the answers we've given on specific educational type questions. And of course, the more elaborate Q&A process, which we've done already, which I think has been extremely useful. I think that should also continue. And as we can see the various things coming out from what we're doing now, I think that process will be required going forward. But I think a two-tier system will be very helpful. FAQs type of system.
I also think it gives us the ability possibly to answer one or two more questions than we might otherwise have because of the concern around the authoritative nature. So I think it's also useful from that perspective.
Yes, hopefully more than one or two, or hopefully a good deal more. There are a number of things that came through, which were clarification type of questions that people were asking. You could see people in the field were not too sure about certain things, which we thought were straightforward. And I think if a number of people can be seen to be not very sure, then I'm sure there are other people out in the field who would actually gain value from those clarifications if we issue them as FAQs.
Well, I would like to bring support to the idea of going to a two-tier way of responding to the needs for clarification. One, having the level of an interpretation, so being of a mandatory nature, and along the lines that Stephen described, so you have real filters before you get into an interpretation, and you want it to be taken in a broad perspective, not be limited to the narrow circumstances that have been put to your knowledge. I'm perfectly happy with the second tier being part of the educational material. I concur also with Bruce that as soon as you have something that is issued by the IFRS Foundation after some form of due process, it carries some authoritative nature. And we have the case in full IFRS with the rejection notices that the IFRS Interpretation Committee issued. So that would be the support. I would also like to bring this issue in the context when now the IFRS Foundation has reviewed the strategy and has decided to be more responsive in terms of interpretations. So that if we are true to our objective, and I think it's been reaffirmed yesterday, that this document is a standalone document, that they apply to different companies, and that there is a little or even no overlap between the two, then I think it's not fair to say that the why this standard should be interpreted should keep away of any possible implication for the full IFRSs. Because, I mean, the communication around the standard should be such that this does not happen, and that because full IFRS exists, we're not prevented from bringing clarification and interpretation that may be needed in practice of the IFRS for SMEs per se. In terms of mitigating the risk that although we all agree that the standard should be revised only every 3 years, I think you can use interpretation with some form of early application possibility and an effective date that comes when only the full review of the comprehensive review of the standard takes place.
Are you of the view, I just want to check on that interpretation issue, would you say that's even the case if we're talking about identical words? So the identical words sitting in big IFRS and in IFRS for SMEs.
Well, I mean, then you have to consider your objective. If you have the objective of having some form of consistency in practice, you cannot stay away from the interpretation of the standard when, in fact, the actual wording leads to divergent practices. That's my first part of the response, not the one that you expect. Second, if you do it in the perspective of how this standard is supposed to apply, and if we are clear that the criteria and the way we think about the issue takes into consideration the differences between the companies to which it applies, I think it could end up with interpreting the words differently.
I think perhaps the right answer there is to be relatively sensitive when that issue comes up and understand what the repercussions might be. I think at the end of the day, even though we've got two standalone standards, there's a family resemblance there, and that family resemblance has the potential to cause interpretations to cross over. So, anybody else? All right. Yeah.
I just want to say that I agree with Françoise about the danger that QA's for SME are going to affect the IFRS. We have written a common letter twice about undue closer effort and impracticability. I think that word also comes back in full IFRS.
Yeah.
You say people that really easily will maybe take the wrong conclusion for full IFRS. So that's the big danger that we as a firm see for QA's.
So would it be a fair summary then that pretty much everybody would agree with the idea of a two-tier system where one would be a fully authoritative Q&A process that actually becomes part of effectively the operation of the standard? That would ideally be the exception that we would only issue if there was a real problem that we had identified with the standard as opposed to using for anything else, and that the second tier with a lesser due process to hopefully defocus that would then focus on trying to give educational material around that. Would be filed as educational material, would be kept in the same place as educational material. And importantly, if an SME didn't see it, it would be the same as them not seeing the other educational material. It doesn't in any way bind them.
I think also by even just introducing the two-tier system, I think it'll allow people to realize that, you know, when we're just issuing Q&As, those are not really...
It helps emphasize the
that's what I'm saying.
Difference.
Whereas if something is issued in the first tier, then we believe... You know, you need to step to date to that.
But what are then the criteria to distinguish between the first and the second tier?
I think the starting point is that we've got to consider the first tier as being a very high hurdle. Mm-hmm. It needs to be something that we actually, if we had our way, would try and correct the standard.
Yep.
The second one is to help people use it.
So that's one part of the due process that we haven't implemented yet that's in the terms of reference is to have some system on our website where people send in issues they have in the field. I wonder if anybody had any comments.
Yeah. We've introduced a FAQ system on our Institute website around SMEs. I'll tell you, it's taken ages to actually get these questions out there, because the moment you start saying you're going to answer them, it opens up a can of worms around interpretation. We're having that at a local level. If you guys start doing that as the ISB, I don't care how many caveats you put on it, people will see that as authoritative answers. I would caution the ISB very carefully around doing that.
Is the concern that we hear too much?
Yeah, I think
it comes in too unfiltered in that circumstance.
I think you'll become a hotline for small practitioners. I think every time something comes up on SMEs, they're going to be running to you, and then you're going to have to be selective on who you answer and who you don't. And then, of course, those that you don't are going to get very upset that you don't answer them. And then when you answer one question, somebody will say with a slight permutation, what if I had this? Well, I think that unless you're planning on tripling the staff in the SME division, you're never going to get that done properly.
I think of it more of an idea of issues to come to that we could look through to see which issues we should bring to the SME implementation.
The only thing I worry about that is the moment you start soliciting questions, then you almost end up with that having to give a reason as to why you haven't addressed them. Yeah. You know, I think you know, you guys are at the center of a lot of the political stuff around accounting, and I'm saying that if we as a country submit 10 questions and you don't choose to take them in, well, I want to know why. Like when we ask the IFRIC to address something and they tell us why they're not addressing it. I would ask the same of you, why are you not addressing my issue? I think this is a massive issue. Why is it not a Q&A? Why is it not a second tier? I just think you're going to open up a very, very difficult thing to maintain. And I think that you
provide a link to the Your Institute site.
Our Institute.
Our Institute.
but that has been our experience in South Africa, is that, I mean, we've been trying to get those questions on top of itself, and we finally got some up, but it's taken forever because it had to go through an internal due process around the APCR, Accounting Practices Committee, to make sure everybody was comfortable, because even though the local institute is not the standard setter, it's the local institute, and we accept that there is a level at which people will see that as authoritative. And I think if the ISB do anything around that, even if you're not answering them, just taking the questions, you're going to have to start giving reasons as to why you haven't addressed them. And I think you could find that a very, very time-consuming exercise.
And then the reverse of the question is, given the fact that we've got a very widespread user base, we've got a user base with limited resources to actually ask, to get, how else do we solicit questions or understand what's happening out there in that network?
Look, I think things like this RFI have been very useful. I mean, I think that a lot of people, we submitted 2 letters out of South Africa because we couldn't even get agreeing on certain things. And I'm saying that I think those type of things would be useful. So, you know, for want of a better word, every 2 years you could send out an RFI. I mean, you can almost do it every year if you wanted to. It doesn't mean you have to answer, but you know, what are the issues you're facing? What are the issues that we're seeing? And interested parties will comment.
Is another way of thinking of it to encourage the national standard setters in each of the individual countries to set up something similar.
Yeah.
That means that they're dealing with smaller volumes, they're dealing with country-specific issues, and then in turn encourage the national standard setters to escalate anything that they feel is more relevant or more.
But I think you're going to end up with that by default with the level 1, level 2. Because I think that what will start happening, or I would anticipate, is where we see major issues, like we submit an IFRIC agenda request, I think we would do the same on this and say we're issuing an agenda request around a level 1 or level 2.
I think what we're probably looking for here is we already have a existing requirement in our due process to do something in this space, and we're trying to find a way to be responsive to that requirement. It seems to me perhaps working with the standard setters to say, well, you do it in your area. You're right, it's going to happen already, but it gives us the ability to say, look, that's the approach we've taken to getting this out. We've got a pre-filtering system in place, which is the national standard setters.
I think that would be a very good idea. Or you could just put Michelle's phone number on the website.
Yes, I think I really like what you just said, because that comes back to what I said right at the beginning yesterday, that one of the big missing gaps in this is the role of the national standard setters. You know, I think that's really quite critical. And where there isn't a functional national standard setter, the local institute, maybe, so that the first level of filter effectively, and that would I think practically speaking, that makes a great deal of sense. The ISP should not be dealing directly with practitioners, really. The national standard setters are the missing item, and I think it's actually.
And I think ideally that will help us to filter out things like national legislative requirements. Yes. We talked last night about issues.
That's right.
All those kind of things get filtered before they get to us.
Mm. And some of us, like even with us in Syria, we're currently building up the capacity to deal with that sort of screening. We're actually building, we're identifying people who are going to be our key people on certain standards in certain areas, and we're actually finding some of our SMEs right now. So we will have that capacity, and I think we encourage building a role for national standard setters, as we thought about yesterday, throughout the whole management of this process, not just Q&A, but the whole process of the standards as well, and communicate that to them, and perhaps even have a little section in the standard that says, you know, how national standard setters can engage with the ISP to help this work properly. I think you will find it will serve a two-way benefit, because it will also help the national standard setters become more aware of the value of their role and being the capacity that's necessary.
Yeah.
One thing I don't understand from Bruce, actually, maybe because you have more experience in this than I do, is the point of not answering questions and problems that come with that. We didn't answer a good number, and I'm not aware that we did have a lot of kickback from them. So I'm not sure why we will have additional kickback if we choose to filter. Like, I'm sure, I mean, I know Michelle filtered quite a few. She told us a number of that were not answered, and we never got back to those people, and I don't think there was a kickback.
I just think if we put a process on the website where you can formally start requesting the ISP to answer things.
Well, I think the problem is it becomes public.
That's it.
And then you get the question around due process.
Mm.
Whereas I think we receive a lot, as I've noticed in the last month, we receive a lot of emails coming in asking us for advice on various issues. And that serves as a pre-filtering, because it's done privately. You can answer the question in very broad terms with as many caveats as you like. But it allows you, not the moment you've got that in public, you have a greater interest in what the response is that you're giving, and you've got more risk of unintended consequences.
I think Andrew has been waiting for
Sorry, Andrew.
I was going to say, we have to bear in mind that national standard setters are not created equal, so some have a lot greater resources than others. And what works for South Africa might not work for other national standard setters. Having said that, I think you've come around to a position or a proposal that I would be comfortable with. National standard setters with limited resources, I think, would welcome a hotline to the IASB.
We would, of course.
But what one of my concerns as we went through the Q&A process initially was, where were these questions coming from? How were we determining whether or not there were widespread or pervasive issues? And I thought that the proposal to have a facility on the website to accept questions would help us assess whether these questions were isolated or whether they were widespread, and therefore we needed to escalate them to the level of a Q&A. So even if we open questions to national standard setters, presumably we still need some way of assessing, is this thing widespread or is it isolated?
And maybe we can borrow a little bit from the process that the interpretation committee uses, where we could, once an issue has been escalated to us, if you have this kind of infrastructure in the national standard setters, you could just ask the national standard setters if other standard setters are identifying a similar group. So that might, but I think what we're looking to do here is to try to, and that the hotline reference scared me, but I think what we're trying to do is filter the stuff coming through, and it was the point I think Bruce made about the resources we've got available for this. So some kind of filtering that says that ideally issues that are jurisdictionally specific or can be easily resolved don't get through to us, so we're actually dealing with a smaller group or smaller, a subset if you like. Mm.
Have joined the conference.
Just on time. Hi, who's just joined us?
Hi.
Hi. You're joining the I4S for SMEs working group?
Yeah. Yes. This is Wei. Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I'm sorry I'm late because there's something wrong with the telephone. I'm in Wei from Ministry of Finance, China.
Welcome.
Thanks.
Just to let you know where we are, we're on Agenda Paper 2, and we're discussing the last issue on Agenda Paper 2, which is the Q&A session.
Okay. Thanks.
Taking stock of everything that has been said and with which I really agree. I think if you make it public, that going forward you're going to have this two-tier system, the interpreter for formal interpretation, that would be, and then that you address other needs for clarifications with the educational material, I think you could open that website question area, which would not be a Q&A, but would be a question area, so inviting people, in fact, to identify the issue they have so that you are guided into the education effort that is needed. So clearly saying right from the front that you're not going to answer those questions, they're just going to be giving you substance in order to direct the educational effort that is needed. I think the standard setters can have a role, but unless the objective of this standard is changed, I would not be in favor of having standard setters giving guidance. I don't think there is so many issues which are very, very specific. I think you need some local help to understand the substance of the issue, but I'm not sure that it makes the issue really specific. So if there is the encouragement of standard setters responding and giving a guidance, I think you're just developing multiple IFRS for SMEs all around the world. And that is something that you can consider, but I think it's a different objective than the one that you've started with. So having the national standard setter have a role is one thing, which I think is a good idea. But having them say, well, deal with your local issues and just come to us only when there is an issue that requires our implication is not is really something I'm objecting to, because I think it's leading to as I said, multiple IFRS for SMEs developing.
Actually, that might be a better way, and I think the idea of wording our website so we actually don't ask for questions, we ask for suggestions in developing educational material. That really gives us the ability to say we will respond to it through the educational material we develop over time, gives us access to questions, and to the extent that we believe something comes up that we can resolve through a Q&A, we can then make that decision on our own, but we've got no obligation to answer it in that circumstance. I would still be reluctant to completely shut the national standard setters out. I think it's useful for us to get, but I think the point is very valid. We need to be careful that that doesn't get overstretched and doesn't get into something. I mean, I'm guessing from, and I really should know this, that is my institute, but I'm guessing that the South African one's been going for a bit and it is working at the moment.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess an effect comment is that a lot of it is local. So I'll tell you now, the majority of the Q&As are scoping issues on different legal entities in South Africa who can use it. So it's very much, when it's interpretative in terms of, well, here's the standard, how's it tying to our various legal things in terms of that? And I think that's the majority of the stuff I've seen.
Perhaps a way for us to think about it is perhaps not directly encouraging national standard setters to develop their own, but say to the extent that they choose to develop their own guidance, these are the guidelines they should think about. And one of those should be, it should only be local issues.
or issues that are easily resolved through educational, no, it should only be educational issues, perhaps.
I think it's going to be difficult to hold that position, though. I mean, it's you know, to turn around and say to people they shouldn't issue guidance, I mean, the big four firms issue books. You know, it's the same thing. You know, you can't turn to them and say, well, sorry, guys, you mustn't issue your books. And I think it's going to be difficult to tell people not to issue guidance. I think that's going to be a difficult line to put out there.
The primary role I saw was a filtering role, I mean, a first review role, really, which I think serves everybody's interests. Now, in terms of issuing guidance, there's some areas, as he quite rightly says, where, I mean, if you're talking about the Companies Act 2009 in Sierra Leone, implications for this, I mean, the ISP has no role, and only we can answer that.
And I think this is now, again, another one of those balance questions. So I'd agree with what both of you said, but I think your point is also very valid, that what we don't want is the situation where standard setters start to overstretch, if you like, such what they're actually doing is developing a new IFRS for SMEs, just kind of through the back door.
Well, wait for that. I most of what I do is management, right? And really, I'm first and foremost a management consultant than anything else. And the way for that is to have a memorandum of understanding with NSSs that states respective rights and responsibilities both ways. So that way you have actually a structure that defines what each party expects of each other and the limitations of the role that you expect. I think that'd be the way forward.
It's no different to being on the first day. It's not, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I think that's what I'm saying. I think it's very difficult for us to turn around here and say, we don't want you to issue guidance on SMEs. They may choose to do it in bigger, when there's a frequently asked questions and in institute stuff on big IFRS as well. So, you know, I think it's going to be very difficult for us to sit and say to people what they should and shouldn't do at a local level. I think you've just got to trust the national sense that they're not going to overstep that mark. But I mean, there's no way the ISP can police that. I support what you say. I think that rather asking questions around, where do you think we should develop educational guidance would be a lot better, because if we get 500 people saying we need educational guidance on leasing, for argument's sake, now we know that there's an issue with that and we can pick that up. Whereas if nobody asks questions about leases, well, we're not going to go rushing into one question out of one country on leasing. So, yeah, I think it would give us an opportunity for that.
Because I think the big things we can take out of this, we would like to think of we need to think of a way to interact with the national standard setters, to encourage particularly local guidance to be developed in those local areas so that there is some kind of local support network for it, but we would need to govern that fairly closely to make sure that we're not getting out of hand as far as that's concerned. And maybe a memorandum helps, maybe just simply because we just need to think about how we would go about that. In terms of the actual website issue, we developed the website to just change the focus to help us develop instead of send us your questions. And then use that as a feeder mechanism, along with the national standard setters, for questions that we think we need to address at this level.
I worry that will cause more confusion than anything else, frankly. I think if it's a question, it's a question. If people need clarification, they need clarifications. I mean, what I don't understand is why the questions that are asked need to be displayed on the website. You can submit them on the website. They don't need to be displayed on the website. So to that extent, you don't have that problem of everyone knowing what questions have been asked. But there should be a facility to submit.
I think to an extent you still have, and I'm still a little bit nervous about the fact that you may have huge volumes coming in.
Yeah, but you filter them through the NSS. That's what I'm saying. If you use the NSS as a mechanism.
The moment we set up the website, we don't know whether those are actually going to go to the NSS first or they're going to come directly to us. Mm. So I think we're probably all saying round about the same thing. What we might need to just think about is exactly the mechanism we use to do it and what the kind of point is. I think it's also a fair comment. Do we want to try and keep the questions confidential, or do we actually want to open the questions so that other people can see their question and say, yes, I agree with that, we need to resolve that?
What IFAC does, if I may quickly, is to give member organizations a password to access certain facilities on the website. I don't see why the NSS is... couldn't, the arrangement couldn't be that NSSs have a password once the memorandum has been signed through which these questions are submitted. So you don't actually open it to all and sundry. You actually open it through a structure that has been carefully designed to provide maximum benefit.
You know, Dale's an alternative to that. I mean, the one thing you could do is, I mean, you know, the ISP website requires you to register even to get the SME stuff. You could make it that people have to have registered, and obviously that it's displayed who it is and the question that's raised. I know it's strange, but maybe, you know, if you're going to put them publicly there, put the "this is raised by you know, Frank Timmins in South Africa type thing, I think then you'd almost become a filter unto yourself. Well, do I really want my name asking that question? Have I thought about it? You know, people would be a lot more, would give a lot more thought to a question they put out that's public than just a random thing where I can submit questions. So something maybe communications guys will probably know better about the type of stuff coming in and how we could filter that.
I think I would prefer the questions to come in and be collected, but not be seen by the outside world. I mean, the sense of the questions, the implied way people, it gives no control from that if it's all going to be put on. So I would think I would prefer to encourage a portal to get questions and issues in, but not show the world what they are. And if there happens to be common issues on issue, you know, then it provides a direction for use within the IASB.
Okay. A quick one. What could be useful is to follow the economists. If you go to the economists' website, you have what they call the cloud, the comment cloud. And if you want to have some sense of what questions people have been asking, you could have, if it's possible, if you design some sort of cloud that actually shows the number of questions on each section of the RFS space. I mean, so people just get a sense of where the questions have been coming from. Well, they don't need to see the detailed questions. And that would also provide some interactivity so people can actually.
You might be starting to stretch my technical understanding.
but let's say for the moment that I will have a look at the Economist and see what it looks like, guys internally, and see what's feasible.
It's actually quite effective.
I'm thinking we could also have a website facility that is only accessible to national standard setters. A little confused as way. That hasn't been suggested so far. That seems to be the simplest solution.
Is there active involvement from national standard setters across the board at the moment, to your general knowledge here?
Well, is there a way to do it right now?
Hmm? Yeah, no. But I mean active involvement with constituents in particular jurisdictions.
In my jurisdiction, yeah.
We don't know what's, because this has been a black hole really as far as the IFRS family is concerned. I mean, there's talk now setting up AFAS to coordinate national standard setters with full IFRSs. And the talk is, of course, that the IFRS SMEs is probably the most important standard in the sense that it has the greatest number of constituents. But there's no similar interaction, no similar structure of interaction with NSSs. And I think that's a major gap.
Yeah, if I can just comment, I think we've just got to be careful with this definition of national standard setters. I mean, if I take South Africa, who's obviously very active in this, it's not the national standard setter who's very active in this space, it's the institute. And there are two different bodies. So, you know, so I'd just be very conscious. I mean, if you only open this up to national standard setters, I can almost guarantee you get very little out of South Africa.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need to understand that, you know, and that's the problem. Once you start opening it up, we've got about six different bodies in South Africa. Now they all, you know, I'd be concerned about limiting it. I think if we're going to do a website where people can submit, let people submit. Don't put it up publicly, and then, you know, let you guys can filter it and decide where you see the big issues coming in.
Right at the beginning, I did say NSSs and or institutes. I did actually say that at the beginning.
But I just don't even know if I'd limit it to them. I'm saying.
Well, the problem is, so once you start saying it's interested parties, then it's possibly the people sitting around this table right now.
Well, I mean, you could take other people. I mean, I know it's been a big issue with people like the ASAF setting up. I mean, if you take a look at, I mean, you know, what about regulators? Yeah. You know, I mean, EFRAG is not a standard national standard setter or an institute. You know, and that's the problem. You start, you know, very interested parties wouldn't have a way into that. That's why I wouldn't limit it. I think anybody who's got an interest in being involved in giving feedback of this should definitely be encouraged to do so.
So have we gone back to opening it up to then to anyone, to individuals?
I think what we're saying here is there's a whole bunch of things that we've learned through this. I do think there are a couple of issues in terms of what's feasible, what's technically doable. I agree that the point is valid, that there's an awful lot of people we're dealing with out there, and it's going to be difficult to lock them down. To an extent, because maybe some of the institutes and standard setters have stepped away from this because the SME standard exists, because they see it as a low maintenance option in a place.
in fact, I wanted to support the idea that it remains open, and maybe with Bruce's proposal having people registering, that could in itself indeed be a filter. I wanted also to comment on the IFAS meetings, because I don't think the scope of those meetings has ever been limited and excluded the IFRS for SMEs. What is likely, though, is that not everyone around the table in those meetings would be interested in IFRS for SMEs. But I think there is a case to suggest to Tricia O'Malley to have maybe a supplementary separate session for dealing with the IFRS for SMEs issue. Yeah. Because there is nothing in the setup that limits or excludes the IFRS for SMEs.
That's a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I think maybe the big takeaway here, and to a certain extent we circle back to where we started, and the big takeaway is then for us to go back to thinking about how we can do a website here, how we can solicit but also control expectations around questions that get raised directly here. Then I think that's something we can go ahead with, because I think that's something we largely agree on. Then I think as a second part of this, we need to consider how we can interact with constituent bodies out there that will provide some kind of filtering mechanism for what comes through to us. I think that's a completely separate step, and perhaps we take a little bit longer with that and just consider what the various ramifications are of going down that route. I think there have been some very useful suggestions here, but we maybe need to just spend a little bit longer thinking about it. There are more unintended consequences here than seemed when we started talking about it.
Darrell.
First step might be preparing some sort of outline paper for the IFAS meeting in April. I think there's still time for something to be included on the agenda on this.
I certainly think it's worth me having a chat with the guys here, just getting a feel for what we... My one concern with that body is, given what's coming to it in terms of things like conceptual frameworks and the like, they're going to have their hands very full. And it's whether or not there's capacity on their agenda for this sort of thing, and also what are the type of issues that they're going to be discussing. Given that the intent of that body right now as it stands is a purely technical intent rather than a strategic intent, and a lot of what we're talking about is more on either the strategic or the operational, they seem to fit in between those two.
Yeah, it's blocks at the moment, because with the ASAP is actually going to take a huge chunk of what IFAS traditionally was doing, and so I think there's going to be a redefinition, and IFAS is actually looking to redefine its role, and I suspect quite welcome something like this to help.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, it's definitely worth looking at.
Mm.
Anything else?
Just an observation on the educational material, and specifically the training material that we've developed for each section. Right now, that material is much larger than what we have here in the standard itself. It's very difficult, if you have a specific question, to go to the training material and find the answer. So I think we need some way of helping practitioners and users to navigate the training material.
That's a good point.
That's what we're taking back to the education group. Mm-hmm. That's a fair comment.
Mm-hmm. In other words, instead of being laid out by paragraph. Because the questions are, it is laid out in the same structure as the standard, and the question, the illustrative examples follow the paragraphs in the SME standard.
I guess that helps. Mm. That helps.
Well, that's what's currently done at the moment.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, so we certainly need to remind people that you can navigate it that way.
We have an index, but that might be quite difficult to...
Maybe I wanted to say to include the hyperlinks for the users can navigate into the material more easy for search.
I think we can definitely give feedback to the education department to think about ways that they can...
Yeah, I was thinking if you had an index by topic,
I guess
then you could list the questions...
So I guess what you're really saying is that the users of the educational, or a chunk of the users of the educational material, aren't using it to read the whole chapter. They're using it for reference material. And we just need to keep that in the back of our mind when we develop it.
Yeah, I think right now in my jurisdiction, very few people are going to the training material.
Well, certainly what I've seen of it being used is it's used more as training material. I'm going
to
teach you
to
about
do it, yeah.
chapter 19.
Not but not as reference.
Find out how to deal with a particular
no.
issue.
Okay. Anything else under this topic? Any
yes, the last part, question 12C, is a question we'd like your feedback on, is how should Q&As be dealt with during this comprehensive review? So, for example, do you think they should be deleted and incorporated where applicable, or should they be retained separately? If we incorporate them in the standard, obviously they become mandatory. If we retain them separately, we can keep all the guidance there rather than condensing it, and they will remain non-mandatory guidance.
Isn't that the same discussion as we just had about the two tiers? I mean, if it would have been a level one question, I think it should be included in the standards. If it's not, then it would not. But then afterwards, I think we have seven Q&As at the moment. Make a distinction between the two levels, according to me. So existing questions.
Almost grandfather the existing questions into the new
second.
Correct.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Yeah. I agree with the staff position in incorporating in different ways each Q&As, but in one specific, the first of 2012, I believe that is the most important of all the Q&A that we are developing. The refer of the using the Angie test. I believe that it is very important, and that test has to be incorporated in the section 2 because it is clearly a conceptual principle.
Okay. That sets the guideline, but we get to it later in paper 3. But it does set the guideline in terms of the principle. So what you're saying is where it is conceptual, or where it is one of these tier 1 type things, we would look to try and incorporate it. And I would guess to a certain extent there may be some issues under the tier 2 that we would also potentially incorporate, if it's helpful.
Yeah, I think it should be the same as the effects. I mean, the intention's got to be that if we can include it in the guidance and we think it's valuable to adding in, why not? I mean, if we're going through comprehensive. And so far, the kind of stuff we've done is just guidance to, you know, to assist people. If we think that has value in the standard, put it in.
They have all been put in the education material now. Yeah. We've updated that. So it's just whether or not we want to maintain them, or whether we want to delete them all and just take out of them.
Or should we go through them? Is that not a better way?
I think it might actually be easiest to just walk through them because so starting with the first one, 2012-04, cumulative exchange differences on disposal.
It's over.
That was a clarification.
Yeah. Last long.
So just suggest a modify to the wording. We're happy with that.
Yeah, I think to some extent the Q&A, this first super Q&A, has to do with the appearance of the IFRS for SMEs. So I think they're related to the early stage of existence of the standards. And they have to do with, to some extent, lack of clarity, especially in the first one we're discussing. We agreed there were some double negatives that introduced some potential confusion. So they're not so much akin to an interpretation, because we weren't really asked to interpret certain types of transactions. We were asked to clarify some fundamental issues, such as the scope, such as undue cost of effort. So to me, it seems to me the natural way to deal with them would be to incorporate them in the standard, and then see going on as more preparers use IFRS for SMEs, is there something that is more akin to an interpretation?
And Henry, would you have that view for all of them? Because there's, I think, one a little bit further down which deals with trading.
Trading in a public market.
Trading in public markets, which is difficult to incorporate.
Yes, and some of them have to do also with the relationship with IFRS, which I do think, following this notion of not being too binary, is something relevant. I mean, we shouldn't completely ignore IFRS. I mean, we should recognize that some preparers will apply IFRS for SMEs and be subsidiaries of full IFRS, hence this the very first one.
So I mean, if
it's worth considering as part of the introductory paragraphs, of the standard to, you know, additional guidance within the standard per se.
So that's, I think, what the suggestion is with the first ones. We can easily enough modify that just to get the to clean up the wording, and that would mean we clean up the wording and then get rid of it. Mm-hmm. The second one we've already dealt with, the fallback to IFRS 9.
Yeah.
Jurisdictional fallback to IFRSs.
I wouldn't include that.
Hmm?
Like training material.
Training material.
Q&A.
Yeah. So we keep it as a Q&A, in other words, so train that one as a tier two training material. We'll sort of run through it fairly quickly, and if anybody's got any objections, I'll application of undue cost and effort. We're going to pick that up on A13, so let's leave that until we get there, I think, on the third question. Interpretation of traded, this is where we said too detailed to incorporate, so keep this as tier two Q&A. Mm-hmm. Entities that typically have public accountability?
Well, that could disappear given on the board's decision on scope. So, mm-hmm. If we retain the public accountability in the scope, then I think we should put it into the standard. If the board choose to take that out, then that Q&A falls away.
I didn't hear what you said.
So what I'm saying is, we discussed that yesterday. I'm saying if it's all around public accountability. If we take public accountability out of the scoping, well, then that Q&A falls away, in essence.
I think we keep the intended scope, though, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry because, again, I arrived late yesterday and I didn't participate in that first part of the discussion, but I had understood that the issue was not to change the scope of the IFRS for SMEs. It was to lift the prohibition of applying using the IFRS for SMEs when you didn't fall under the scope, and that would be left to jurisdictions to do so. I thought it was the essence of the discussion, so that, in fact, I didn't understand that deciding from an ISB point of view that this scope definition would disappear, I didn't understand, was on the table.
That was my understanding, too. I thought that everything would stay down, we'd just remove the one paragraph 1.5. We'd still have the same intended scope, the same mindset.
Yeah.
Just that we remove the paragraph 1.5 in case there were jurisdictions that felt there were entities perhaps that were more akin to non-public accountable entities that should be applying the standard.
But I'm saying, I think once the board's made a decision on what we're going to amend in that scope, we need to relook at that Q&A.
We need to think about whether Q&A still works in the context of whatever new
word. Exactly. So we can't just now say we're going to put it in or take it out because we don't know which way the board's going to go on. Yeah, it depends on that decision.
How the board's going to, or how are we going to choose to word it, and etc.
But this notion of public accountability remains relevant. So, whatever applies to it is relevant in the training material.
It does, except if the board takes a decision that we're not going to say whether public accountability or not is relevant, we're going to leave that to the regulators to decide. Then we end up in the situation of saying, well, why are we then commenting on what is public accountability and who should be there if we're leaving it to the regulators?
So I think that's because not to revisit yesterday's discussion. I think perhaps leave us to think about how this would be worded in the context of yesterday's. I do think some guidance may well still be appropriate.
But may need to be made.
But we need to think about how we're going to word the changes that we talked about yesterday and how that actually comes across. So this one is sort of pending depending on how other decisions work out.
Sorry.
Quick operational question. We know that any changes to the standard won't come through probably 2015, but what about this change to the Q&A system? Is that going to be more... Is it going to happen earlier? Because that will affect some of the questions.
I think that would likely happen, but again, we'd have to go through a due process, wouldn't we, to actually get this clarified.
Right.
So I think it's certainly not going to happen immediately.
Yeah.
Okay, the last one. Do we want to pick this up in paragraph 1.6, I guess, is the first question, and then you said it should be easy enough to do.
I think just with a few extra wording.
Yeah.
I think it's easily be picked up.
Okay. What I'm saying is we're probably going to be left with two educational Q&As that will remain behind afterwards. Everything else is either incorporated or possibly not relevant.
So, clarify on what were you planning to do with the last one? Incorporating it in?
It'll be incorporated in, yes.
Yeah, we've had some problems with this in the States. This one
can be read to be in conflict with Section 9.2, which requires consolidated financial statements, which was discussed when the Q&A was originally issued, and I was in the minority with some others on the issuance. So I guess that I personally think that conflict should be resolved, whether it's putting an exception to 9.2 or not. But then in the States, we've also had some interest in this with private entities in the States can pick whatever basis of accounting they want. And there's been some questions about the requirement to present full IFRS in order to avail yourself of this Q&A. And I guess the question is, well, can you use a local GAAP if you present consolidated statements under local GAAP, or do you have to use full IFRS? So I would just pose those two comments.
So what you're effectively saying is we need to just take cognizance of some of the confusion that's been created around and just make sure we get the wording right. Do you think the answer we've got is generally correct, or do you think we've actually got the wrong answer here?
No, but I was outvoted, so okay. See to the group's wishes on the question. But.
Is anybody else encountering concerns with applying this particular? Because the worst thing we can do is take a Q&A that's not working in practice and stick it into the standard.
I mean,
Tom, what might be worth doing is perhaps just outside of the meeting, if you can circulate around just a view of what exactly is going wrong here. It sounds like most of the people are aware of it. I'm not too sure I'm understanding it, just so we can make sure that we've thought about it in what we put into 1.6. Are you aware of the issue?
I think it was in the one of the comment letters, same issue, okay. Yeah. But I didn't agree with it.
So it may be something where we just need to change a word or two, and that might actually resolve the problem.